Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Thank you, Bob Kessler. This is John Williams, and here we go on our Saturday show. Bob, you were not there with me last week.
No, I was hanging with Willie and family.
Willie and family?
Willie Nelson and family.
You'll understand that I didn't know exactly who that was.
Which Willie I was referring to.
I don't know your family that well. So where was he, and how was the show?
Willie was at the River Edge Park in Aurora.
Yeah.
And the show was great. Chris
Willie
Christopherson.
Willie Nelson's playing parks in Aurora. Huh?
Yeah, they put a lot of people in that park. Oh,
yeah,
you should
okay.
have seen it.
I don't mean to disparage the venue, but I think of him as a little bigger than Aurora. But
yeah, last
good.
Time I saw him was Ravinia, but this was pretty close size-wise.
How does he sound still?
Oh, he sounds great. Sounds like Willie. But I'm acquainted.
He never sounded good.
Right.
No,
well,
really.
He sounds human.
Willie Nelson
know?
Was never – I'm a Willie Nelson fan. He was just never, to me, a great vocalist, but he was a great singer. Or
right,
never a
from
great
a technical
singer,
standpoint.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Well, some of the greatest singers can't sing. Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Willie Nelson, there you go.
Well, speaking
right
of that, in a way, can I just share with you one little bit of audio here? This is Peter Frampton. Peter Frampton put out a new CD this year, or album. It's called Acoustic Classics.
Yeah,
I'm only bringing it up.
One.
I just interviewed him the other day, and I don't even know if I'm going to play the interview for you all here, but maybe I will one of these Saturdays. He's touring this summer. Peter Frampton. Frampton Comes Alive 40 years ago this year. So now he's redoing some of his old songs, but acoustically, which is weird, and then he's got some new songs as well. And it's like, wow, Peter Frampton, what do you sound like these days?
The stars are red and shiny, but all I really want to know, oh, won't you show me the way? Yeah.
Now, I listened to the whole album this week, and I had real affection for it. It was really, really nice.
Oh,
and
nice.
By the way, just here's how, remember this?
The talk box.
The talk box. Whatever happened to that? Okay, so let's talk to Dave Ennett for a second now. When you think of Peter Frampton, you think of Dave Ennett from WGN Radio Sports. Hi, Dave. How are you?
Thank you, John. How are you?
I'm good. I asked you to jump on with me today to talk me off the Cubs shelf, okay?
Okay.
Or ledge. Let me just tell you what you already know. The
okay.
Cubs have won 51 games.
Yeah,
they have lost four of their. They've lost six of their last 10. They lost two in a row and 10-2 last night to the Mets. Blah blah blah. But the Cubs have won 51 games. But now Texas has won 52. The Indians have won 49. The Nationals have won 49, and the Giants have won as many as us, 51. I thought we were going to run away with MLB this year, and now we're one of the top six teams, but it seems like everybody is catching up and we're fading. What should I think about this, Dave?
All right, let me ask you this, John. If I had said to you back in January...
Nope,
April.
I'm not going to answer this.
No, I just want to ask you. No, just this is fair. On the 4th of July, you're going to have like a 10-game lead in the National League Central. You will be among the winningest teams in baseball. Aren't you going to be kind of okay with that?
Oh, I'm going to be kind of okay with that, but I want to be more than kind of okay considering how well we did in the first half.
All right, how many games did the Cubs win last year?
I don't remember.
97.
Really?
So, yeah, and they're going to surpass that this year. Now, they may not win. You know, for a while, it looked like they were going to maybe top the Mariners of 2001 and set the record for the most wins in modern times and smash all those records. And that was somewhat unrealistic, I think, because it's very hard to maintain – the pace they were on over the course of an entire season. And if you'd listen to voices of reason, even back then, people were warning there's going to be some bumps ahead. Joe Maddon was saying it. There's going to be some bumps in the road along the way. That's not to say it's a team without flaws. There isn't a team in baseball without flaws, and they're definitely going through a rough patch right now. But I still think if you look big picture, you have to feel pretty good about where they are. And it really doesn't matter if they finish ahead of Texas, because that's not going to determine home field in the World Series. It's which league wins the All-Star game.
Three series just have a bad taste in my mouth right now. One is this one, even though it's not over.
Right, right.
The Cardinals and the Nationals. Last time we played the Nationals. And I'm like, you guys, these are the teams we're going to have to be beating. These are the series we need to be demonstrating that we're appreciably better than we were last year.
All right, so they played Washington in a four-game series at Wrigley Field and swept them. And in the series in Washington on the last road trip, what they were two of the games Washington won, I believe there were walk-off wins. Otherwise, it's not like the Cubs walked into Washington and got blown apart. They didn't have a very good series at San Francisco. The first two games of this series have not been good. But you're coming back now with Arrieta and Lester, the last two games of the series in New York. So I would wait and see how you feel tomorrow night after these next two games. Now, if they get swept, then I think Cubs fans are going to be in not quite in full-blown panic, but getting a little bit concerned.
Right. Well, okay, would you grant me that, though? I am on to something here, right? Like, is it possible I'm just tapping into something here, Dave?
Well, they're not playing as well as they were. But you've got about a month. No.
Well, that's true.
That's it, though, John. I mean, you got about a month to go until the trade deadline. You've got a bunch of guys who have been on the disabled list for this team, some of whom will be coming off shortly. Dexter Fowler should be ready to go. I think he's eligible to come off next week, but so close to the All-Star break, they might just pick the safer route and wait until after the break. Yeah. Tommy LaStella is close to coming back. Soler still not there yet. But the fact that they've been able to win 51 games, considering the injuries they've had, you know, I think Cubs fans ought to feel pretty good about the depth that they've shown on this team. And look, it's like I said earlier, I mean, every team has flaws. They've got some flaws. They need to shore up the bullpen. I'm sure they're going to make some moves here by the deadline to do that. They're trying to maybe help their rotation too. Adam Warren has been down working on being stretched out so he can come up and start on this next home stand. So they're basically going to go to a six-man rotation to close out the first half. And who knows, maybe he'll emerge as a guy who's going to provide a backup for that starting rotation if guys like Jason Hamill continue to struggle like he did last night and like he did for much of the month of June. I mean, I just think there are some answers that they can come up with. This isn't a situation where everybody's got to say, oh, man, lost cause.
So you think we are going to win the World Series then? Is that what you're saying?
I didn't say that, John.
But you know, it's
– I'm not worried about having the most wins in baseball. I mean, they're going to be among the top teams all year. I don't think they're going to fall off the cliff.
I thought we were special this year. I thought this was going to be something that they just said, wow, Madden had the lightning in the bottle that year and nobody could touch us. And then I look and I'm like, well, we're a run-of-the-mill, top-tier team. I know I'm exaggerating my case a little bit, but I'm just watching the standings and I don't love what I'm seeing. And if this were the end of the season, it would be different, because isn't the attitude, Dave, that it's not how many games you won or what place you finish in, it's how much momentum do you have, which direction is your team going at any given time? And you'd rather just squeak into the playoffs but be hot than be the dominant team all season but be fading in the playoffs. And this is, you know, this isn't the playoffs, but I'm just reacting to the momentum of the club right now.
Right. Well, and I think that's a valid observation. If you remember last year, they were the hottest team going into the playoffs. I mean, they won, I think, their last eight regular season games, something like that. And they carried that over into the regular season. I think that's less important for them this year than it was last year, because they hadn't been in the postseason and it was a young team. I think now they get into September, if they have things pretty much in hand and they know they're going to postseason baseball, I think they'll be able to maybe adjust certain things that hopefully they'll be in a situation where, you know, guys will be more comfortable and they won't feel like they were fighting to get into the playoffs last year. Maybe they won't need to be fighting to get in this year. Maybe they will, but it certainly doesn't feel like that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Can I change subjects? Yeah,
I don't think you need to be panicked, John. That's all I'm saying. Are there concerns? Of course. But I think it's like a team that's a long way from Panicsville.
Yeah, I know. Well, one last question or topic here for you, then I'll let you go. John Williams on WGN, Dave Ennett, of course, who you hear on Steve Cochran's morning show, among other places. Were you surprised by the Joakim Noah deal?
I was. I'm not quite sure. Look, he's been a great competitor for the Bulls. He's been, I think, a great citizen in Chicago, great guy for the community. He's, I think, a good player before the injuries really set in the last couple of years. But for a team to go out and spend $72 million over 4 years for a guy who's 31 and has shown signs of breaking down physically, it's a head-scratcher.
Have they seen his jump shot? They know, right? They know about what he does with the basketball, right?
I would think so. Well, they needed a defensive center.
Yeah,
and there's no question that he's a great defender. But
when he's out there,
how good can he be? How good can he be coming off this shoulder surgery at 31 and with a couple of injury-racked years just behind him? So I'm like everybody else. I wish him well. I hope that he is able to succeed. And not at the Bulls' expense necessarily, but I hope he does well. But you kind of look at some of the deals that are being handed out in the NBA right now, and you say, who are they looking at here? What player are they talking about? I think they're not looking at the players.
I think they're looking at the money they have to spend, and it almost doesn't matter.
They got all this money from TV, but you know, Mozgov signing his deal with the Lakers for just a ridiculous amount of money, $64 million after playing sparingly this year and averaging, I think, 6 points and four rebounds a game. John, you could double that.
I have played professionally before. Did you know that?
I'm not sure exactly where you played professionally, but I know you're a very good player.
I played for the Chicago Dogs, which was an independent minor league sort of catch-all team that played in high school and junior college gyms. I was signed to a one-game contract, and I was one for one from the field.
So you retired with a shooting percentage of 1,000?
I was paid $100 for that performance, and the check bounced. It's true.
Was that the most they could pay you under the salary cap?
All right. I'll let you go, Dave. It's good to hear you. You getting ready for Northwestern football this fall?
Yeah, about 2 months away. But it should be a fun year. And hopefully you'll join me in the booth one day.
Yeah, I want to get back up there. All right. I'll visit with you again and listen to you on Steve's show.
All right, John. Thanks. Be well.
Dave Ennett, WGN Radio Sports. By the way, last week we mentioned that tickets had just gone on sale or were about to go on sale. We're about to go on sale to our Teddy Roosevelt show. I need to give you a few details on that because they went on sale this week. Stick around. We'll be back with that information on WGN. Abraham Lincoln was Teddy Roosevelt's favorite president. TR and I are going to be on stage at the College of DuPage, is Mack Center. It's a wonderful stage and theater. I don't know if you've been out there before, but it's where we do a lot of these Jefferson and Roosevelt conversations. And this one's going to be August 13th, 10 a.m. That's a Saturday, August 13th, 10 a.m. I don't know where you're going to be, but tickets went on sale Tuesday, I believe it was, and we're about half sold out. So there are still some seats available. They're moving pretty quickly, and I'd really love for you to come to this event. To be honest with you, I don't know what tickets cost. I think they're about $30 a piece. It's worth every bit of it. If you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. No, I won't. But still, it's a really good show. August 13th, 10 a.m. at the Mac. And I thought I would just grab from one of our previous shows a bite of Roosevelt on stage with me. This is him describing what it was like for him when he first went out west.
I went out to Dakota, to North Dakota, when it was still Dakota Territory, to kill a buffalo. I wanted to kill a buffalo. I got out there, and when I got there, this is really the moment when my life changed. I got out there, It was the 7th of September, 1883. I got off the train there in the middle of this Badlands country, and I was wearing a designer suit of buckskins. I had had a designer suit of buckskins made for myself, and they were the most beautiful and pristine and precisely cut buckskins in human history. There wasn't a stain on them. They looked like they'd been bleached by God. And I had a silver buckle that was hand-carved and spurs in silver with my initials T and R and a knife hand-carved by Tiffany's. And that's how I started my Western adventure. And if you can imagine it, some of the local boys, the cowboys and ranchers, took a sort of umbrage at this. And they called me Punkin' Lily, and they called me Interloper and Carpetbagger, and they called me Harvard Man. And they, if you can imagine this, they called me Dude. They called me a dude. And this really upset me. And I didn't want to be a dude. I didn't want to be a rich, spoiled kid who came out to kill a buffalo and then disappeared. So here's what I did. I did everything that an authentic American cowboy can do, never complaining, never calling attention to myself. My job was to wrestle these calves to the ground, and I would hold them there. They would drag them in with a rope, and I would wrestle them to the ground, and then somebody would come up and snip off their testicles and put a hot brand into their flank. My job was to hold the calves down during this operation, and I must tell you that they do not find it exciting. And they squirm a good deal. And it's very dirty and hard work and terribly exhausting. But I did it without complaint. And one day, there was a man just like you. A cowboy who was dressed to the nines. He looked like a character out of an Owen Wister novel. He had a slicker, and he was striking poses for the ladies, and he was not paying attention. He was trying to look like some creature of the Old West. He wasn't paying attention, and because of that, some of the calves were squirting out of the circle. And if you've ever been on a roundup, if those calves get out of the circle, it is almost impossible ever to convince them to come back. And so I was down on the ground waiting for the calf to be brought in, and without even thinking about it, I looked up at him and I said, and I quote, "Hasten forward quickly there." It just seemed natural to me. Hasten forward quickly there. That's what one says. And for the rest of my time in the Badlands of Dakota, whenever I would see these men on the street, they'd say, "Oh, hasten forward, Mr. Roosevelt." And in the saloon in Medora, North Dakota, I'm not a saloon man. I hope you're not. I'm a sarsaparilla man myself. But in one of the saloons, I'm told that there was a drink called the hasten forward. So it took some time, is my point, to be accepted as an authentic He-Man.
Well, he was eventually. So that's just an example of what it's like when he starts telling one of his stories. Teddy Roosevelt on stage with me. College of DuPage, August 13th. You can get tickets at WGNradio.com/events. And then there's a link right there to the Mac. There's also a phone number you can call. WGNradio.com/events, WGNradio.com/events. His tour with us this time is sponsored by Conasec and Dillon, and also Visit Springfield. Thanks to our sponsors for helping us out. Still to come, the Mincing Rascals have a few things to say. That's our weekly roundtable on, well, news in Illinois, Chicago, and certainly the national scene. In fact, the Rascals this time are talking about the Clintons more than usual. Hillary Clinton's had an interesting week, and Bill was on the plane. It was sort of like snakes on the plane, only now it's Bill on the plane, and nobody wants Bill on the plane. The Rascals mince about that after the news on WGN. I had to laugh/cry, Bob, when I saw this trending on USA Today today. So I was just clicking through their website, looking at it, and then they had one of these headlines, and it says trending. 13% prefer meteor hitting Earth to Trump or Clinton. That's bad, because
yeah,
I don't think they meant
0%.
One of the... it should be 0%. You're right, because they weren't even depicting like one of the ones you find out in the woods, like, hey, look, a little meteorite. They were talking about something that kills dinosaurs, you know, something gigantic, better that than Trump or Clinton.
They're talking 13%. 70s disaster movie level.
Yes, a Will Smith, you know, one of these things where guys got to get in ships with atomic bombs and
save
us.
That's 90s disaster movie level. That's higher.
I guess so. There was a survey this week, and it said that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are actually neck and neck. That was the Quinnipiac poll. I think I'm saying that correctly.
I think you are.
Well, I'm always...
used to vacation there, you know.
Oh, did you really?
No, I don't know. It sounds like a vacation place.
Doesn't it, though? Yeah. It's also a university. They also do a lot of polling. And so what I have done is I've put the name Quinnipiac in my little machine here, and if I hit a button, it'll tell me how to pronounce it.
Quinnipiac. Quinnipiac.
You just go on YouTube, and you can find all of these pronunciations.
It's not one of those fake ones like you had recently.
Kokokinakwoa.
Yeah.
Kokokinakwoa.
Yeah, because next to Quinnipiac is...
Kokokinakwoa.
Kokokinakwoa. You may call it quinoa, but it's Kokokinakwoa. And then once you go down that road, you just can't stop.
Harsdoosties. Harsdoosties.
Be those little sandwiches on coffee tables, you may say, hors d'oeuvres. Let's let the Mincing Rascals have their turn here now. This is a sort of abridged version because a couple of the regulars were not able to join us this week for the podcast that we record every Friday that you can find right now at WGNplus.com or on my Facebook page. I'm King John on Facebook. So Krista McQuarrie, editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune, was not in the room, and Steve Bertrand couldn't make it either. But fortunately, Eric Zorn was able to join us, and I had the first word on this week's Mincing Rascals. Former President Bill Clinton got on a plane just to have a friendly chat with Attorney General Loretta Lynch, even as her office was investigating his wife's use of her email server. What was he thinking? Now, Loretta Lynch has been forced to say, okay, I'm not going to recuse myself, but I am going to accept whatever the findings are of the FBI and the career prosecutors in this case. If they recommend that we go forward with this, then I will. And if they say no, I won't, but I'm not going to weigh in on it. That was probably what was going to happen anyway. Now her hand is forced, and the optics of this are terrible. The Clintons sometimes cannot get out of their own way, Eric.
Well, that's true. My guess is that they probably didn't talk about the case. Certainly she said they didn't, and he indicated that they didn't talk about the case, and it would be bizarre if they had. I think what he was probably thinking was that, well, he could go and make sort of a friendly visit to her that no one would know about, because it's not, you know, I don't know exactly how this came out that this happened, because it wasn't like this was a scheduled meeting. He apparently just walked over to her airplane, and he thought that he would talk to her and kind of butter her up a little bit, and that would be that. Obviously, what has happened here is, if there was ever any chance that Loretta Lynch was going to put her thumb on the scale in favor of Hillary Clinton, that chance is gone now.
Exactly.
He totally ruined that, and he made it more awkward for them not to file charges.
Even if they didn't talk about the case, and I think you're right. I don't think she's a liar. Let's assume that they're both telling the truth about this. They didn't talk about the case. But it is sort of softening up the jury, if you will, if he goes over there and says, hey, let's talk about our grandkids, and on some level.
Yeah, that's
just as heavy-handed as presenting evidence. It's still a manipulation. You should not do that.
Yeah, obviously you shouldn't have done it. The news, of course, this morning is that Loretta Lynch has recused herself and has said that she's not going to be part of this decision, which is, I think, fair.
What is he thinking? He's got a good political ear.
No one's going to know. That's what he's thinking. What was he thinking when he fooled around with Monica Lewinsky? He's thinking no one's going to find out.
Boy, I thought he was smarter than that these days. And by the way, this notion, just if you think that the Clintons are part of an elite class, this notion that my airplane is over by your airplane and that I'll walk over to your airplane and ask if you, what, have any gray poupon?
John, doesn't this happen to you? Come on, when your private jet is parked out of Midway and you see another person's private jet?
And go, hey, pull over, yeah. That's Cindy. Cindy, hi, hold on. And then I'm running across the tarmac. Good Lord. And then you think nobody's going to notice? Your Bill Clinton satellites are watching you. Are you kidding me?
The people who really know about how the law works here keep saying that there's probably not going to be any indictment of Hillary Clinton. But let's play that out, though. What if she is indicted? What happens then? Who steps in? I think you can't run a candidate for president who's under indictment.
Oh, Lord, yes, you can.
Oh,
against this candidate, you can. I was thinking about that, though, Eric. And then this happens. Thank you very little, Bill. What are you going to do? Run?
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden?
Sure. Uncle Joe. Everybody likes him.
You know, wouldn't it be funny if the Democrats did the same switcheroo that some people still think that the Republicans are going to try?
So it ends up being like Biden against Romney or something? Yeah.
Or, Rubio's going to run for Senate now, I guess. So there goes that. Let's talk a little bit about the Benghazi report. The Chicago Tribune editorialized that while there's no bombshell here, it looks really bad for Hillary Clinton.
There's a little bit of similarity with this Bill Clinton and Loretta Lynch thing, isn't there? I mean, it's like the appearances are bad. There wasn't a big smoking gun in this Benghazi report. There wasn't any. There was no suggestion in there, and this has been one of the big things, was that if she had acted somehow differently or if she had acted more responsibly, that those victims would have been saved there, whatever malfeasance there was about security really wasn't an active decision that she had made. On the other hand, there's this business about how this was presented to the public afterwards. And again, you got to think, what are these people thinking? When I think back on this, was September 11th of 2012, I think was the date, right? You know, 2 months before the election, a little bit less. And this compound, this diplomatic compound is overrun by a violent horde, and 4 Americans were killed. Why do you have to try to spin that as related to a video as opposed to being a terrorist act? I just don't understand what the political calculation was. Why anybody thought that was going to change any votes? I mean, clearly they weren't prepared for that attack. Clearly it was something that happened. So whether it was, and I actually agree with what Hillary Clinton's been quoted as saying. It's like, after the fact, after this compound has been overrun by armed people, that there was not enough security, what difference does it make what the motivation was of the people who were attacking the compound? But all of that gets lost in the fact that they were trying to spin it one way rather than just be straight with people.
I'm a little surprised, though, that she gets the pass about preparedness.
The question with all these things, the question comes down to judgment, right? And you have to say, does Hillary Clinton, and this is what our editorial got at and what people are asking themselves, does Hillary Clinton have the judgment, the good judgment to be president of the United States? And, you know, the answer may be, well, ideally you'd want someone with who has shown better judgment. But in the real world, you've got a choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and all that.
Oh, yeah, but did not the Tribune also sort of question her honesty? Remember, your editorial also pointed out that Hillary sent an email to her daughter saying one thing, and then the talking points for Susan Rice the next day were something different.
Well, she didn't write the talking points. The CIA wrote the talking points.
Still, it sounds like Hillary Clinton knew one thing and said
right.
that to her family and then said something else to the world.
Right. I think that comes through in this report. The question is, how big a deal is that when you look at the grand scope of things, when you look at the character and honesty and fitness for office of both
candidates?
Yeah, but
don't you see a trend here then? So look at the
sure.
last two conversations we've had. The Clintons are always a little bit above the rest of us, aren't they? They don't have to play by our rules. They've been getting away with it for years. Lord knows they're smart, but their integrity is a little questionable at times.
It is, but Donald Trump is a flim-flam man. I mean, you know, this is the
we
thing.
We can talk about Trump, but let's at least the Clintons own this.
I think we should. And I think, this is obviously not an election between two almost perfect candidates or even ideal candidates for their own parties. This is, you know, some of this Clinton stuff was why I was immediately so big on Barack Obama in 2008, because I just this all the Clinton, all the mishigas that comes with the Clintons and their the way they do things, the way they talk about things. I just didn't want to relive that, and I have had some of the same reservations when she started running this time.
I said, oh, yeah, wish she was not the candidate. What do you think of this statistic that Chicago is on a pace right now to have an Orlando every month? This is eclipsing far and away the most violent summer, and June the most violent month we've seen in a long time. I almost, if I were the police chief or the mayor or somebody, you know, you almost want to throw your hands up to the West and South sides or wherever the next shootings are going to occur and just say, you know what, you guys have at it. Fine. I'm not going to put my people in harm's way. Clearly, we can't get in front of the bullets. We can only pick up after the fact and then try and find the people that did it. So fine. If the community can't, if the families can't, if the thugs can't figure it out, I give up. I quit trying.
Yeah, of course, the problem with that is not if the gangbangers were just killing each other, you might have a little bit more acceptance of a thought like that. But there, you know, people are hitting the crossfire all the time.
Yeah.
In this Sunday's paper, it's going to be my recommendation, but I think I'll just get out in front of it right now. It's called 10 Shootings a Day, Complex Causes of Chicago's Spiking Violence. It's going to be a big story by Annie Sweeney and Jeremy Gorner, and it's already online. And it talks about how, you know, halfway through this year, homicides are up 49% in the city, up to 312 already. These are levels that we haven't seen since the late 90s.
Well, let me read a line from it. About 416 people were killed or wounded in 333 shootings in June, a sharp spike from last June, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it goes on and on. It talks about how two of the city's most historically violent districts, Harrison and Englewood, account for a fourth of the homicides and shootings. Basically, they're saying that what is happening here is what's happening. There's a number of factors, but one of them is that these huge street gangs that we remember hearing about, you know, the Black Peastone Nation and the Gangster Disciples and so on, they have broken up into what they call cliques of really small factions that fight each other. So you'll have, you know, people who used to be under the same gang umbrella who now live close to each other and are trying to kill each other all the time. I heard a very interesting report on Channel 11 the other night where a guy was talking about how social media has played into this. Social media accelerates violence and anger. That the kind of, you know, the taunting and insults that you might get on the street are now broadcast to the world on social media, and so the demand for you to respond, to, you know, take revenge on someone who disses you, becomes greater. So that these social media posts and these videos that these guys are creating, mostly guys, are fueling this violence. So they also talked about, you know, the question as to whether the police are standing down for one reason or another. Dean Angelo gave a speech, the Fraternal Order of Police head, on Tuesday, where he said street stops were down by 150,000 so far this year. It's 150,000 people the police did not stop, did not search, did not question. He said that the real problem is not the Ferguson effect, you know, not that they're afraid of being caught on video, but it has to do with the paperwork they've got to fill out. That the because of some consent decrees that, with the ACLU and so on, that they've got to, you know, fill out extensive reports on all these street stops in order to detect whether there's racial disparities in the people that are deciding to stop. So.
And now let's go to our recommendation part of the show. Steve Bertrand, what's your – oh, never mind. Kristen McCrory. No, they're not.
You know, here. Kristen McCrory, last time she was on and I wasn't here, she recommended that you go online and read – past editions of my column.
Which, funny, I don't remember it that way.
I'll recommend that for her again.
Well, you don't blame him, right? Thank you very much, Eric Zorn, part of our Mincing Rascals crew. It was just the two of us this week, but I still think it's a pretty good podcast, and you can hear all of it at WGNradio.com, WGNplus.com. It's very easy to find there. You can like me on Facebook. We always post the Mincing Rascals there, too, and I'm King John on Facebook. Just by the way, one last thing about that reference to Orlando. And wasn't that a great sentence by Eric when he was talking politics? He said, this is not an election between two almost perfect candidates. No kidding. We were talking a little bit about what happened in Orlando, though. And I'm wondering what your reaction is to that McHenry gun shop and shooting range that wants to auction off a rifle and then give the proceeds, an AR-15, and then give the proceeds to the Orlando victims. Is that a genuine attempt to actually be part of the solution, to help out? That's what the owner of the gun shop and his son say. They say, no, we feel terrible about this. We want to make a donation. Or is that just kind of opportunism? Is that a little crass? I don't know where your head on that is, but I'd like to know. My number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Call me and give me a reaction to that story and where it is right now. The way it appears, since they're not a nonprofit, they're not going to be able to do that. Maybe they'll find an end around by either becoming a nonprofit or, you know, pairing up with somebody who is. But what's your reaction to them making money that way and then at least giving it to the right cause? 312-981-7200. This is WGN. By the way, I hope I didn't describe this story incorrectly, Bob. You can help me out on this. My understanding is that they're not doing that AR-15 raffle because they're not a nonprofit.
Right, yeah.
But the Tribune says that, let me just see if I can quote them here, they are still considering options such as partnering with a nonprofit for a future possible raffle. So maybe they are going to put this on hold, but it doesn't sound like they're giving up the idea
not entirely,
that they can
no.
sell a gun, and then give the proceeds. And I love one of the mothers from another shooting victim. I think it was the Colorado shooting. And she said, this is like, you know, auctioning off whiskey to give to the victims of, you know, drunk drivers or something like that. That's just, it's so tone deaf. You know they know that. You know they have to realize that this looks a little odd. And so the only conclusion you can come to is that it's just promotional. They're just doing this to get their name out there. In fact, they must also know that it would be upsetting to the people that are the victims or the family members or people sympathetic to that. And it has to be more like thumbing your nose at them. You know what I mean? How else can you interpret it? Griff, what's the name of the first? Sonny, this is John. You're on the air. Go ahead, Sonny.
Yeah, I just don't see anything wrong with, and thank you for taking my call. I just don't see anything wrong with them selling the rifle and donating the money to the victims, as I understand it. That's the way it's supposed to be. Yeah. I just don't see anything wrong with that. They're not keeping the money. They want to donate it and give it to the victims. And so I don't see where that's hurting anything at all.
I think the difference between you may be that you're a gun owner or would like to have an AR-15, and I'm not and wouldn't. Is that probably true?
Well, I don't own an AR-15, and I really don't think I'm going to be acquiring an AR-15. I do support the Second Amendment in this country that Hillary and Obama is trying to take away.
I disagree with you on that too, Sonny.
Okay, well, that's okay. Well, we all have our opinions, but if they can, they're going to take it away. That's what they're trying to do, and most of the Democrats are trying to do that. So it's not a big secret. All you got to do is check the record. You'll see.
Thanks for the call, Sonny.
Thank you.
Here he goes. Well, the one interesting statistic I saw is that you would think, and the AR-15 is a very popular gun, but the vast majority of shootings in this country are handguns. It's still handguns. That's the gun of choice. And so this, you know, if we sell more or less AR-15s in this country, is that going to impact much people getting shot in this country in terms of total numbers? Probably not. That may be the weapon of choice for mass shooters, but if you're just doing raw numbers, it's the handgun that we are all using to kill each other in this country, and that's really where maybe the focus needs to be. But I think anybody that's doing something like this knows that we're polarized on this topic. And it's just a way, I think, to thumb our nose at the other side, to say, oh, guess what? We can still sell guns. In fact, we can have a raffle for one, and we'll give you the money, which makes us look like the good guys. But you know we're not on the same page. In fact, you almost wonder if the charitable organization would take the money from the raffle sale. So say they did have one. They said they still want to do one. They write that check and send it off. I think that's a very interesting moment for the charity itself. Do they take the cash or not? The news is right around the corner, and this is WGN. Thanks for that, Bob. This is John Williams. By the way, you mentioned Garrison Keillor in your news. In the latest issue of Time magazine, the cover story is 240 Reasons to Celebrate America Right Now. They include some gripes, which is unusual because it's a celebration kind of issue, but they have Garrison Keillor. And I just wanted to read a paragraph before we go to our guest. Blair Kamen's on the line. He said, 9 things to fix now. I won't give you all, but here's the sense of it. Number 26, kill the airport announcements about reporting any person who asks you to carry something aboard the aircraft. Nobody has ever done this. Number 27, likewise, the flight attendant's demonstration of how to fasten a seatbelt. We know how. Number 28, stop making pennies, nickels, and dimes. Nobody bends down to pick up a dime anymore. They're not worth the trouble. I don't think everybody agrees with you on that, Garrison, but we get your point. Number 29, change the seating in Congress to mix Democrats and Republicans together. Teachers know you break up gangs by keeping them apart in the cafeteria, seat politicians by seniority, and mix the Democrats with the Republicans. That is a good idea. Blair Kamen joins us now on WGN Radio. Blair, welcome to the show. I trust you're well. Thanks for giving us some of your time on a Saturday.
Hey, John, it's always good to talk to you.
I've been enjoying what you've been writing lately about the Obama Library, but also about the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art, which is, I guess, not going to happen now. That's a done deal, right? There's no way there's going to be a 25th hour thing and this is going to get done?
It's done. They're gone.
And what? And do you say to them or to that good riddance? I mean, what's your attitude about that, Blair?
No, a good riddance from the lakefront, but I thought it would have been fine if they had gone west of Lakeshore Drive. The big issue here was that George Lucas said that he only wanted a site along Lake Michigan. He was rigid. That was, you know, it was going to be his way or the highway. And basically what happened is that Friends of the Parks contested that in court. A federal judge said that they had enough of a case to let the to proceed. That delayed things. Lucas didn't want to wait. And so a week ago Friday, he said, I'm out of here.
I had a bad taste in my mouth, though, in this whole, and it may turn out to be a great museum, even though I don't think any of us ever really had a sense of what was going to be in there, and maybe it'll be too bad that we don't get it. But I had a bad taste in my mouth because it just seemed to be a cram down to me, like the rich wanting to get their way, and he doesn't even live here, you know?
Yeah, well, it did seem like a vanity project, and as you're saying, it was ill-defined. I mean, even the website of the museum, interestingly enough, had images on it of paintings from, you know, that were supposed to represent what was in George Lucas's collection. But it turned out that some of those paintings actually were displayed in other museums, and they were honest about that to some extent. I mean, they had a disclaimer saying, you know, not all these paintings are in our collection. They represent what we may be buying in the future. So there, you know, it's like, well, okay. But I mean, there was always the sense here that, you know, the public thought this was a Star Wars museum because Lucas is so associated with that wonderful movie, which I am a great fan of, or series of movies, but it wasn't. It was really going to be a combination of his collection, which ranged from, you know, Norman Rockwell paintings to material from his movies, Star Wars and others, to digital art. And you kind of wonder whether people would have shown up once out of curiosity, expecting to see, you know, Darth Vader's mask and lightsabers and things, and then, you know, said, well, where's all the Star Wars stuff? And then they would have, you know, gone away disappointed. So you wonder if it would kind of, you know, be the kind of museum where people would visit once and then never come back. We'll see. I mean, you know, as he's going to California, and we'll see if it's a going, if it's an ongoing attraction. But yeah, there was certainly that, always that question about, you know, what the heck was this thing?
Well, I was talking to your colleague over there, Eric Zorn, about this, and he said, you know, it's a parking lot right now. Better a museum you don't know, like, or understand, or even go to, than a parking lot. I mean, you know, that's maybe a better public use of that space. What's your thought to that?
I think that's garbage. That's Rahm Emanuel talk. That's, you know, Friends of the Parks is Friends of the Parking Lot. Look, first of all, Rahm Emanuel and his Chicago Park District control that parking lot, okay? If Rahm Emanuel tomorrow wanted to convert that parking lot into parkland, he could get the money and do that. So all the stuff about, you know, it's a parking lot, it's ugly, it's terrible, is a bunch of hooey. I mean, you know, like, look at Northerly Island, what was done there. You know, they took Miggs Field and they turned it into 40 acres of parkland. So, no, I don't agree with that. This land is covered by what's called the public trust doctrine, and essentially that means that certain properties are held in trust by government for the benefit of us, the public. And this was one of those. And so putting a privately controlled museum on that land violated potentially the public trust doctrine. That's not me talking. That's Judge John Dara talking, the federal judge who presided in this case. Now, people always say, well, what about the Shedd Aquarium and the Field Museum and the Alpha Planetarium? Those are on Lakeville, you know. Those are on public trust land. What about those? Well, those were built before the 1970s when the public trust doctrine became a weapon to prevent environmental degradation. So it's kind of like they were grandfathered in. And, you know, there's a problem with over-concentrating the lakefront. If you put too many museums on the museum campus, it starts to become more museum than campus. And all of a sudden, you know, you got traffic jams and roads and parking lots. So, no, I don't agree with that at all. That whole Rahm Emanuel shtick I thought was, you know, very clever, and obviously it a lot of people, you know, bought into it, but I think it was a complete fabrication and real demagoguery over that site. And right now it's on Rahm Emanuel to convert. Having complained about that site and called it an eyesore, it's on Rahm Emanuel to turn it into a park. And if he doesn't, you know what we can call him? Friend of the parking lot. Okay? Friend of the parking lot. Mayor Rahm Emanuel, friend of the parking lot. He's got a few years to convert that. Let's see what he does with it.
Well, you know, it's interesting you make this point, and I don't know that they would share the same road or parking space, but I think the museum campus is about maxed out anyway. It's almost it almost doesn't have the support for it that it could use. It should be easier to get in and out of and park over there, if you ask me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a column tomorrow in the paper which compares and contrasts the Obama Library and the Lucas Museum. And one of the points I make is that spreading the wealth, and by that I mean the cultural wealth, is smart policy. You know, interesting, President Obama didn't demand a site along Lake Michigan, but George Lucas did. And President Obama is going to build his museum and library right next to two poor and predominantly African-American neighborhoods. Now, George Lucas didn't want to do that, but President Obama did. So the point here is that if we spread our great cultural attractions along the lakefront, not only do we decongest areas like the museum campus that are already over-congested, but we can uplift neighborhoods that could really use it. The boost that you often get from a cultural attraction. That, to me, is smart policy, and that's one of the many things that distinguishes the Obama Library going forward with the debacle of the Lucas Museum.
I wonder if George Lucas's wife, Melody Hobson, wants to walk back that statement about not putting it where they want it will deny young black and brown children of being able to see a great, you know, cultural thing.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to ask Melody. Look, I thought that was ill-advised at best. You know, wrapping yourself in the mantle of we're doing this for the children was silly. If you care so much about the children, build it west of Lakeshore Drive at a site, you know, where you're not going to run into huge legal hurdles. Or build it in a neighborhood like, you know, Washington Park or Woodlawn near Jackson Park. Those are the two Obama sites where you're not just going to be helping the children who are visiting the museum on occasion, but their families.
The whole neighborhood,
The whole neighborhood by virtue of, you know, attracting economic development to those neighborhoods. So, look, Melody and George are civic-minded. They have donated, you know, lots of money to lots of causes in Chicago. I just don't happen to agree with their – with what they wanted and the way they went about it this time. I mean, one of the things was that George Lucas, we never heard from him during this whole debate. You know, he gave one interview to Charlie Rose, his good friend. And then other than that, he didn't speak to reporters. Well, if you want a piece of our lakefront, which is the most precious land in all of Chicago, you know, you better come to court and to put it in a kind of, you know, Victorian.
Maybe he thought the money would speak enough. You know, if somebody says, hey, we want to put a $750 million project in your neighborhood, that's talking, isn't it? I mean, you know,
I guess it is to some extent, but you know what? I mean, the lake, you know, lots of people over the years have wanted to put their projects in the middle of Chicago's parks, including the Field Museum, by the way. Was, you know, Daniel Burnham himself was pushing for that one to be in the middle of Grand Park, and it was only a court battle instigated by Montgomery Ward that resulted in the Field Museum being not in Grand Park, but where it is today. So, no, I don't think Lucas, you know, was particularly effective in this battle. Silence, you know, if he had just, you know, taken out an ad or written an op-ed column or talked to reporters, showed them, you know, talked about the purpose of the museum, showed people the collection, which he never did. You know, that might have won some public relations points.
That might have helped.
I mean, Rahm Emanuel says, you know, oh, you know, Friends of the Parks would have opposed it anyway. But in terms of the, I mean, the, you know, the mayor should know better than that. I mean, politically, I got an enormous response to a column that I wrote last Sunday, you know, saying that Lucas really blew it by not engaging with Chicago. And I think there's a real lesson here. You know, if you want to build in our cherished parks, you better be willing to walk the walk in terms of community meetings and, you know, engaging with the public because it's their land. That's really what it boils down to. It's their land. And, you know, he was going to get a 99-year lease, John, for $10 with two options for renewals of 99, you know, both 99 years. So effectively he was getting control of that land, that precious 17 acres, for 297 years.
Yeah.
And that's why the, you know, the judge said it was effectively giving control to the Lucas Foundation and privatizing that public asset.
The two great pieces. Lucas reaps bitter fruits of arrogance as Chicago Museum plan collapses. That was last Sunday. And then tomorrow, Lucas, Obama, and lessons for city building. Blair Kamen. Nice to talk to you, Blair. Fascinating as always. Thanks for your expertise.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate you, you know, airing these issues. They're really important. And it's always great to talk to you.
That's Blair Kamen. You can read him again tomorrow in the Chicago Tribune. By the way, there was an interesting story. Let me pause here. We'll come back. But I'm going to ask you if you have ever lost a large amount of money or found a large amount of money in the wall or behind the sofa or something. I'll explain why in a minute. This is WGN. Out of time for calls here. We're going to pause in just a second. Update you on WGN Radio News. We'll let Bob Kessler do that. After that, our Vibe Score segment. We'll check in on all kinds of things and see how folks are scoring the news. And the boys from the beat will talk a little sports with us. Thanks again to Dave Enna for coming on at the beginning of the show and talking a little Cubs and Joe Kim Noah with us, for that matter. But this is the story. I don't know if you saw Bob Kessler. You're kind of busy over there getting ready for the news. But the story was of a guy in Miami. He had a lawn and garden business. Authorities evidently were tipped off to something. They had been investigating him for a while, and they found in 5-gallon buckets from Home Depot, behind a wall at his business, $24 million in cash. He had $24 million in wound-up bills in Home Depot buckets behind a wall.
That's Breaking Bad type thing.
It really is. That's such a scene, isn't it? That's such an image. And I mentioned this on my radio show the other day. I said, well, have you ever found money? Now, this is, you know, a drug operation, obviously, but it's not always that. Has somebody hidden money or valuables in your home or someplace, and then you found it, you know, years later? And boy, people got stories like that. You may at 312-981-7200. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to sneak in a call, but somebody, for instance, called and they said that when their parents died or grandparents died, I guess, depending on who's telling the story, but these elderly people passed away. They went to the house, you know, they're cleaning things up. And in the furnace, somewhere in the housing of the furnace, they found $40,000 in cash and a .44. They had a gun loaded and $40,000 in cash. Some of that is just old school, you know, people who maybe lived through the Depression or whatever, and they don't trust the banks. And then some of it is people just kind of keeping their rainy day funds, you know, like finding a $100 bill between the pages of some books. Some people store cash there. I'm worried that if I did something like that, I get it, you know, maybe you want access to it or you don't want to have it in a shared account so you can surprise somebody with your little kitty, but I would forget where I hid it, Bob. I'd have the money in a really good hiding place, and then I would forget where the hiding place was. Bob, we got to get you tickets to come see our Teddy Roosevelt show.
Is that in August, right?
August 13th.
I'm there.
Oh, no kidding. You can make it? Oh, sure. That'd be fun. You'll have to come up and wave or
at least play
harmonica in the background or something for us.
Ooh, what would be, yeah. The instrument was popular when he was around. It was gaining a lot of popularity.
So maybe
I can do a little research, see like what would a good tune be to learn, you know, what was a popular tune of the day.
That would be fun. Well, it's going to be August 13th, 10 a.m. at the MAC at the College of DuPage. Our conversation with Teddy Roosevelt is sponsored by Visit Springfield and presented by Konasek and Dylan. We want to thank them for making this show happen. And we have had him on stage before. The Roosevelt shows are different than the Jefferson shows. Jefferson is thoughtful and bashful and funny and wise and sad. And Roosevelt is bombastic and hilarious. And as outsized as Teddy Roosevelt is, he's also an intellectual, very proud of the fact that he read a book a day. A book a day, he said. And he authored a lot of books, too. In fact, we'll start this clip where I was trying to recollect just how many books he wrote. I think it was 35?
At least 35, depending on how you count. I wrote more than 35 books, several of them American classics. And let me just say, the next writingest president of American history, who would that be? John Quincy Adams. He wrote 12 books, all unreadable.
You were a Nobel Peace Prize winner.
We settled the Russo-Japanese War, and because of that, I became the first American to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm often seen as a warmonger. And by the way, I do like war. But I was a man of peace as president. I was the first president to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I was the first president to leave this country during his time as president. I went to see my canal in Panama.
My canal in Panama, he said. And I said, really, your canal? Well, that's Roosevelt for you, and he'll be happy to talk about that and charging up San Juan Hill and being a cowboy in the Badlands and the tragic loss of his wife, and his life is just really something. And then what makes, I think, the Roosevelt and Jefferson shows really special is that they reflect for us. We ask questions, what about this current issue or this current event or that person? And you sort of get the, in this case, Rooseveltian perspective on it. Tickets are available at WGNradio.com/events. One last time, you can do this right now. Buy them at WGNradio.com/events. Digging this one, Griff. This is our Vibe Score segment. We always started out with a song. Vibe Score is an app that my cousin Tom Hegberg and I came up with. You get to score the news, we say. It's more than just that, though. There's a music category, a TV, a sports category. We give you information you're interested in and then ask you a scorable question. So what song are we scoring there, Griff?
That's called Shut Up, Kiss Me by Angel Olsen. It's the latest single from that singer-songwriter's fourth album called My Woman.
And what's the name of the singer again?
Angel Olsen.
And she's been around for a while? Have I missed the Angel Olsen bus completely?
Well, she's been rising in, you know, like, I guess you'd call it indie circles for a couple of years here. She's beloved by a lot of people, I think. But yeah, not a huge star or anything. But I think this album more people are hearing.
I like that song. I mean, I like the sound of that song. It sounded fun. Did you like it?
It's louder and, you know, more barbed than a lot of the acoustic songs that she put out on her earlier records. So that's kind of a nice change of pace. And, yeah, I think it sounds awesome. I loved it. I gave it like an 90.
Asked to rate it, I gave it an 85. That's my vibe score
for Shut Up, Kiss Me.
Bob, I'll go 82 on that.
Wow.
I want to
hear
it more. You know, it's like I could hear it maybe growing on me.
That's a good sign, isn't it?
She's got a really interesting voice, and it sounds cool the way she's using it now. So
her average vibe score is what on that, Griff?
It's getting an 87.
Okay, what's next?
In news and current events, millions of Brits have signed petitions for a revote after the Brexit vote.
Yeah, they have.
Resulted in the decision for the UK to leave the EU.
Mm-hmm.
So should they get another vote, or should the original vote stand? And they have to deal with the consequences. We made 100 is yes, they should re-vote. 0 is no, no re-vote.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
17. You do not. There's no do-overs. Elections have consequences. No do-overs. Where are you on that one, Bob? 100 is yeah, they'll get another vote. And 0 is no vote. No re-vote.
Wow, that's a tough one because it's like you made the decision, or you made your bed, you got to lie in it, right?
It's weird, though, because the consensus, the attitude is the only reason we want to do the revote is because we got it wrong.
Yeah.
We want to vote again, and that will reflect our true will. So I understand that impulse. I get it. And this is so consequential that you almost ought to give them a mulligan, but nah, you can't. You can't. Imagine if we did that in the last presidential election or any election. You just can't do that.
Yeah, and then what if it ended up being the same result? It's like, well, we
okay,
really...
then we'll vote again.
Yeah.
We'll vote again. How about you, Griff? What do you have to say about this story?
Not a lot. I don't know. It's tough. I am not sure. And you know what? The votes are on VibeScore. It kind of reflects that. It's getting
shocked.
58.
I know. That's like right in the middle, which is sort of that, I can see it both ways. Come on, people. You do not get a revote.
Leaning toward the revote, our voters are saying.
Yeah, no kidding. They're on that side of 50. I don't mind advocating for my side on these things, as you can tell.
It sounds like you want a revote here. You want on the vibe score.
Yes, I do. I want to revote on the vibe score.
You got it wrong.
So that you'll all vote no, they cannot have a re. My last thing to say about this, Griff, the integrity of the election process is almost more important than any single result. The process will endure. You have to respect that. What else you got?
In the laugh category, we showed Englishman John Oliver using his HBO show last week to attempt to explain Brexit. Speaking of Brexit, to American audiences, and we put the clip up and asked us to tell you what you think. Did you like that? Do you like John Oliver?
I like him more and more every week. I was not a big fan when he got the show.
Uh-huh.
I think he's so consistently good, isn't he? And smart. I thought what he did on this clip is amazing.
I thought
it was really funny.
Yeah, I think the show is very smart. Sometimes I don't find it that funny. And that's what's changing more, I think, as it goes on. I think he's getting a little funnier, but... Like, even if I'm invested in a clip or in a segment that he's doing, when he breaks for jokes, a lot of times they'll fall flat. So I've not been the biggest fan, but I do think it's a very smart show. Bob, have you watched John Oliver's show?
Yes, I didn't see the segment you're talking about, but yeah, smart show. I saw the one he did, the one was on special districts. It was fascinating hilarious.
They kind of pride themselves on that show on taking on like the most boring thing you possibly could.
I love
that
about them.
I do too.
I was going to mention that. I mean, it's a reminder that if it's presented intelligently and you ask people to be just a little patient, we can do this. We can get through some of these important, boring topics like redistricting or special districts or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
What did you give it, Griff? What was your vibe for that segment?
I liked it. I gave it an 80. It was nice to hear it from somebody who has ties to the UK, at least.
Yeah.
It's getting a 70, so pretty good. Yeah.
All right, give us another one.
Chicago Sports, we asked you how you felt about Derrick Rose leaving the Bulls when he was traded to the Knicks. Now we're asking you how you feel about Joakim Noah being traded to the Knicks. Are you happy or sad to see him go? That's what we asked about Derrick Rose. So 100 is happy, 0 is sad.
Well, I'm kind of happy for the Bulls. I think they just need to tear this thing down and then sort of start over. I'm happy for Joe Kim. We all love him, but there's not a lot of tread left on that tire. And he's getting $75 trillion. So more power to him. You know, I think everybody wins on this deal. I think the Knicks are going to be sorry, but that's their problem. And good luck to him. He gets to go play with Derek some more. So I'm giving this a 92, Griffin. A 92. I'm very happy about the trade.
Okay. That'll raise it up because I don't know anything really about the economics of this deal or who got what, who made out better. But yeah. I like Joakim Noah. I'll be sad to see him go. I just went baseline, like, emotion feeling on this. So I gave it a 30. So
Yeah, I can see that because it's like, well, are you sad? I'm sad to see him go. The Tribune has today, like, five classic Joakim Noah moments. And there's a lot of players you can't think of two or three. You can't think of one. There's a bunch of awesome, great Joakim Noah moments, and I will miss that. But like
remember
I said,
when his dad was being interviewed in the stands, and he made a play, and his dad stood up and was cheering like in the middle of that little interview on the sideline?
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Yeah,
the stolen ball, slam dunk. He's been fun. We salute you, Joakim. Thank you.
In the books category on VibeScore.
Okay.
Steven Spielberg's adaptation of the BFG hit theaters yesterday. It is the latest in a long line of movies based on the books of beloved children's author Roald Dahl. His work is the inspiration for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, The Witches, Matilda, James and the Giant Peach, and plenty more. Are you a fan of Roald Dahl's books? What's your score for the author? Now, I'm guessing usually when I push you on children's entertainment, I get nothing.
Right.
Is that what we're...
Well, I'm a little closer to this. I mean, I've read some of these books. I haven't watched the trailer yet. I haven't seen the movie yet, but it sounds like a good movie. But you're asking about
just the author
body
in general.
Of Roald Dahl.
Yeah, are you a fan?
I'm shocked that it's only getting a 68. I gave this an 85. Who doesn't love Roald Dahl?
I know.
Who
I went 90. Yeah.
Who are the haters? What's your? If you don't like somebody, you tend not to read them. But if you read him, how do you obviously enjoy him? I don't understand the 68. We need a revote on that one, Griffin. We need
you
a
don't
Roald Dahl,
you
Dahl
don't
exit.
Get a revote, Bob. Do you have?
I'm a huge Roald Dahl fan.
Yeah,
I'd put him in well into the 90s for his works. I've loved his books since I was able to read them, 10 years old or something. So yeah, I haven't seen the movie though. But Roald Dahl himself, 95. I'll get that score up for you.
We're finding ways to avoid asking people how they felt about movies because no one's going to see anything this summer.
Yeah,
I'm wondering if that's going to be the case with this one. But it's getting a 68. You're right. And I would be around a 90. I think maybe he freaks people out sometimes. Some of these get very scary for children's books and movies, way more than other people are willing to go. I remember watching Matilda as I was a kid, and it was so terrifying to me. And I think The Witches and a couple other, even Charlie and the Chocolate Factory sometimes gets real dark.
That was dark, I'll say that.
Well, yeah.
I don't know that it was scary, but it was like, it was a little twisted for children.
For
stuff,
sure, yeah. Maybe that's what's throwing some people off. I don't know.
Kid gets sucked up in the chocolate tube. You don't know really what happens to him until I think the end of the movie they let
and
you off the hook, but you don't really know.
The bratty girl, Veruca Salt, gets like sent to the incinerator. I mean, she doesn't end up burning, but she... He didn't seem to care if she did or didn't.
That said, you never really had the feeling that he liked kids, so maybe that was part of it, at least in that book, anyway. All right, what do we got next week?
We got a couple more. TV Game of Thrones Season 6. Fans are still talking about this season and the last two episodes now that it's over. What's your vibe for Season 6 of Game of Thrones?
90.
90.
I'm not a watcher, so I can't weigh in.
I went, like, around 80, because I did think it was pretty awesome, but... the season before it was so dark and so punishing that I just hated it for that reason. And this one lifted a lot of spirits without giving too much away, but a lot of good things happened this season. And then I started to resent it for that. I was like, wait, where's the show that I was watching before? So I start to be hard on it from both sides, but it was, that's me just overthinking it, I guess. It was a really fun season.
Well, yeah, I think it's, I've watched all the episodes this season. I've watched pretty much all the episodes of all the seasons. I don't really understand a lot of the things that are happening. You've heard me say this before. I don't watch the show closely enough to follow the family trees, and you kind of got to get into that. But I think the last two episodes were terrific. The second to last episode was horrific. And then this one made everybody feel, like you said, Griff, kind of good again. So I'm on board. 91 for me.
All right, and really quick, in the movies category, we should put up the trailer for Sully, the upcoming movie based on the Miracle on the Hudson, captained by Sully Sullenberger. It stars Tom Hanks, and it's directed by Clint Eastwood. Now, just from the sound of that, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm done with the Sully story. I'm done. I'm surprised they're making a movie out of this, aren't you?
No, not at all. Really? You're surprised? I mean, I don't know how psyched I am about
it, but it seems pretty... What happened, really? The plane had trouble, and then he landed it on the water, and everybody got off of the airplane. I mean,
That sounds like a movie to me, yeah.
It sounds like a landing to me. A movie would be he was a fighter in World War II, and he had 12 missions, and on the 11th or 12th, he almost got shot down, and it's this long, gripping narrative, but... The plane had an engine problem. I'm minimizing this, right? But really, this is it. The plane had an engine problem. He goes, hey, there's the water, and he landed the plane on the water. Touchdown. But I'm kind of done with that. Listen to me, huh?
Bob?
Like, it's easy. I could have done it. It's not so hard.
I think it's time for a Sully movie. Yeah, I've kind of had enough time go by for me to forget it, and now he can remind me. You know, if it was like a year after it or months after.
Well,
it's like,
spoiler alert, Bob. They all live.
They all live. Okay,
okay.
We know how it's
going to
end. Although Clint Eastwood's movies, I run hot and cold. Some of his movies are great, and others are like, really?
I definitely agree with that. So you just never know. So I kind of like being up in the air. We'll see. Who knows?
All right. Thanks, Griff. So that's the end of Vibe Score this week. We invite you to download the app. It's free. You can get Vibe Score on your iPhone. I guess that's all I need to say, right, Griff? You can get it on your iPhone and then vibe away. The boys from the beat are right around the corner. Let's talk a little sports with them as they get ready for their show on WGN. I got just enough time to say hi to the guys here, and then we'll get you ready for the news. Remember, you can also get your tickets to our Teddy Roosevelt show. Circle August 13th on your calendar. If you have a calendar, do people circle things anymore? Anyway, August 13th, 10 a.m. at the MAC, the College of DuPage. Teddy Roosevelt and I are on stage. And tickets, you can buy them right now online or over the phone. All the information is at WGNradio.com/events. Mark Carmen, Kevin Powell, get ready for their beat of sports. What's going on, guys?
Happy 4th, John. Good to talk to you, sir.
Yeah. Happy 4th of July weekend to you.
Back at you. We have a major breaking news today, John.
What's that?
Major breaking news.
Yeah?
I've played Bill Leff in tennis.
Oh, my gosh. About, Bill is like the best tennis player in the world.
Right. Well, right. But see, I played him... I think about 4 times coming into today's 5th match, and I had never lost to him. And I've said on these very airwaves that I would never lose to a chump like Bill Leff. And and today I lost to Bill Leff, John. So I just wanted to get that off my chest, and I'm leaving. And Kevin's going to do the show solo.
I've seen a lot of sad Carmen lately. The last time I sat in with him, he had also just came from a tennis match and suffered a major defeat in a tournament in his club match. So this is the second time in a row I've been with Carmen, and he walks in sort of shoulders slouched over. He's all bummed.
Wow. It's not going well.
Mark, I know you, but I don't know you that well, I guess. I didn't know you were such a tennis dude. You play, huh?
Junkie.
I do. I'm a competitive guy, John. I got my softball on Monday nights.
I'll be honest with you. You don't look like a tennis player to me. So you've got some game. Huh?
Whoa. I don't know what that means, but I think it was definitely an insult, and that's okay. I'm going to process that. We are going to talk some real sports, too. There's these two guys that played for the Chicago Bulls. Their names were Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah, and now they're both New York Knicks. So I think it's a very simple question out there for you. Are you rooting for the Knicks or the Bulls next season? Because I'll be rooting for the Knicks, just to put it out there quickly on the record.
You think they should have kept Joakim?
Well, I can't even say that, but it's just more... it's just because of how bad they've messed up the whole franchise that, okay, fine, you're letting Joakim go because it doesn't make sense for you to keep him anymore because everything else is so broken. So I can't say they should have kept him, but I think the fact that they are at this position where they shouldn't have kept Joakim Noah is sad in itself. Sam Smith's going to be with us at 3:35. He does a great job covering the Bulls forever, and he's with Bulls.com right now, so we'll have good old Sam on at 3:35.
This is a little late to ask, but you say Joakim and I say Joakim. But it's—I presume you're right. It's
Kevin?
Joakim.
I would go Joakim.
It's Joakim.
Okay. I heard you Joakim. Say Joakim earlier, and then I started questioning myself. Well, John Williams is saying Joakim.
Oh Lord, no! don't let me lead you. Just bet the opposite of me. But then, how did you guys say Thibodeau or Thibodeau?
Tom Thibodeau.
That's what I said. So he's the coach now of the Timberwolves, and he said it's Thibodeau.
It is. It's Thibodeau.
It's
but people
Thibodeau,
call him Tibbs.
Tibbs. So I always called him Thibodeau and Tibbs, but it was Thibodeau and Tibbs, right?
You hold on a second. You've talked to Tom Thibodeau, and he told you personally that it's Thibodeau?
Our sports guy, and he goes, they said, okay, we just need to know because they call you Tibbs, so then how do you pronounce your last name? And he said Thibodeau.
That's
Thibodeau.
Okay, so that's he was here for, what, 5 years? And so we're saying that the entire city basically got it wrong for 5 years?
Well, people would call him Thibodeau, but it's Tibbs. I think that's where people were getting mixed up. His nickname is Tibbs, so people just assumed Thibodeau.
How did people pronounce his last name?
I thought they pronounced it Thibodeau. I mean, and
I did too.
Yeah.
I said that was wrong. That's why he left. He got so ticked. He said actually, he didn't have a lot to say about that, but I mean, we were getting his name wrong.
Tibbs was my guy. We bonded. I went to a concert with him once. That's actually a true story, which was really bizarre.
Seriously?
That happened. I mean, it was a late last second invite. There was one ticket available. Hey, do you want to come to a concert? Tibbs is going to be there. So it was me, Tibbs, and a couple other Yahoos all in a box watching something over at House of Blues. No, it was like an intimate Johnny something. You probably know who I'm talking about, John, but I'm getting it wrong. And
that's funny. He doesn't strike me as a guy that would be.
No, I didn't know know he left the court in the film room.
This was after he had been let go by the Chicago Bulls. So he was relaxed, Tibbs. He was.
Did he know how to be relaxed, Tibbs? Because he doesn't seem like a guy that knows how to relax.
I still see the tie kind of cinched up and crooked, and he's sweating.
He had a something with a lime in there, and he was taking the music.
Good.
And I said, "You enjoy?" Said, "Oh, it's great. It's great."
Hey, but John. He's going to do some big things with Minnesota. I think.
Yeah,
he knows what he's doing.
He's got some players to work with, that's for sure. All right, guys, I'm getting the rap in my ear, so we'll be listening to you. Have another good show, fellas.
Yeah, happy 4th, John.